Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
On DAB, online, on the app, and on your smart speaker. This is My Sporting Life on TalkSport.
And with me, one of the greatest goalkeepers of all time. Born in Gladsaxe, Denmark on the 18th of November 1963, the son of a Danish nurse and a Polish jazz musician. And after playing in Denmark for the first 10 years of his professional career, in 1991 signed for the team he supported as a boy, Manchester United. Went on to play nearly 400 games for them, 5 Premier League titles, 3 FA Cups, a League Cup, and part of the historic treble-winning side, culminating with the Champions League in 1999. He then went on to play for Sporting Lisbon, Aston Villa and Manchester City, and still Denmark's most capped player, Peter Schmeichel. How are you, Peter?
I'm good, thank you very much. How are you?
I'm very well. Listen, yeah. You look really well. Are you still in great condition after the playing career? Are there any aches and pains or anything? Because you look okay.
I go in my autobiography, I talk about the injuries that I carry, but I always had a back problem.
Yeah.
And if I don't train, if I don't keep myself fit, my back problem is not great then.
Sure.
So I need to keep some kind of fitness level. But I have to say that COVID, where everything was shot, kind of took me out of the rhythm.
Oh, did it really?
I've been a bit lazy in the last year or so.
You're not the only one. Don't worry, you're not the only one. Now, is it true? So you were a Manchester United fan as a child, growing up in Denmark, right?
Yeah.
How comes?
Great question. Obviously, Man United weren't winning anything in the 70s when I grew up. It was Bayern Munich was winning the Europa Cup 3 times. Liverpool did. Nottingham Forest did as well, 79-80. And Leeds were one of the big teams as well. So all my friends were like Liverpool supporters, Leeds supporters, Forest supporters. But this is my sort of first early memories is Tommy Doherty. Tommy Doherty, just the name sounded really cool. Tommy Doherty, you know.
77, cup on his head.
We promised you last year we would bring the cup back. And we brought the cup back to the finest supporters in the world.
So, and I think that was something about the badge and maybe also the strip, the red shirt, the white shorts and the black socks. I don't know. It's not like I'm thinking that was this one player that I tacked onto and then it was more the other way around. I started to like the club and then I began to know the players. And information about the club was very difficult to come by. It wasn't like now where you just Google everything.
Sure.
And we didn't have a lot of football on TV anyway. Mm. We had whatever game the BBC picked as a main game on a Saturday, only in the winter month. That was a game that we were shown on TV.
So Manchester United kick off. In red shirts and white shorts attacking the goal to our left. Leeds in their all yellow strip.
So I don't really know, but I was a mad Man United supporter. One of my best friends, he was a Man United supporter as well. And everybody else, as I said, it was more Leeds, Forest and Liverpool.
Let's talk about how you started playing then, because yeah, it's a really interesting childhood. Your parents are remarkable from what you write about in the book.
Mm-hmm. So I grew up in a sort of a newly built estate where thousands of people live in there, a lot of kids. And in the 70s where it was kind of a good thing that people were close and, you know, the local community was meant a lot, and life was changing in the way that the mothers who up until that point more than not were staying at home looking after the kids, mm-hmm. and now they were moving into to jobs, and so the whole society was changing. But that sense of community was absolutely brilliant, and that resulted in that community creating a football club, which was right in the middle of where we lived, and everybody was attending this football club, and I thought I'd do that as well. And that's how I started to play. I would play coming back from school anyway. I would just, the first thing I'd do is to drop my school back and then just go up to the fields, which was literally just outside my front door, and there were football pitches there, and just play until, you know, my mother had to drag me back home.
But the thing is, everybody, even over here, I mean, I'm not a million miles away from your age, we'd all do the same thing, but nobody was that good. So how do you know actually how good you are? Is it a very simple thing that someone goes, that kid in goal's really good, and then he moves on to there, and then he moves? Is it as simple as that?
It in a way, yes.
Yeah.
So in my first training session, I was outfield for about 3 minutes, and the coach was a bit worried about the other kids because I was a bit wild. And he said, Peter, try goal. Go in there. And I did. And I liked it. And straight away he said, you're very good at that. So that was kind of the beginning of it. I was told I was good. And as a kid, if a grown-up say that you or tell you that you're good at something, you kind of believe that. Hmm. And then you don't want to disappoint them. And that thinking stayed with me forever. I don't want to disappoint people. People kept coming up to me saying, oh, you're very talented. One day you'll play for Denmark.
That was early, though, wasn't it? Someone very, actually very said that when you, yeah, were, when you were a small kid.
I probably wouldn't have been more than 10 years old.
That's incredible. Yeah. So what was the progression then? Because there's a date, isn't there? 7th of August 1972, which is a huge date for you.
I played my first game ever.
Yeah.
And the reason I know that for sure is that my mother was, she was preparing to go to hospital the next day to give birth to my sister. She knew she was going to be started that next day. So in between packing and preparing herself, she would go up to the pitches and watch me play. We played a small tournament on the same day. So she would go in between there and this is my first kind of memory of, if you can say, success. Because we played this tournament and we ended up in the final, and we ended up in a penalty shootout. Can't remember. I kind of think that we lost the penalty shootout, but what I do remember is that after the whole event, people, they were telling me how good I was, and you're very talented, and not just the coach, but just people who'd been watching the games. So I started to believe that I was really good and I had a talent, and then it's just moved on from there.
With your parents then, because they were really busy, weren't they? Because I know your dad worked in Tivoli Gardens and he was a pianist, and your mother's a nurse, so extremely busy. And often when I hear about kids that play football, you know, their mums and dads having to run them all over the place. Was it pretty much you having to do this for yourself?
Yes and no. My parents were very busy. My mother, the way she worked 7 days on, 7 days off, and she worked from 4 till midnight on the days that she worked. So yes, we were on those days, if my father worked as well, we were left to look after ourselves. But the way we lived and where we lived, it was like that for everyone. So neighbours would just pop in and make sure that we were okay. And if we had to, if neither of my parents were there to make dinner for us, well, we'll get that off the neighbour. So it was nice, safe community. And as much as they could, they supported me in my football. But I had, you know, 3 sisters. There's a lot for them to look after as well. And they had different interests in football. Sure. So they, you know, they divided the time as much as they could. But, you know, back in the 70s, it was a different world. You really had to work hard to make ends meet. You know, you can argue that that was probably a bad thing, but it was the way it was back then.
Mm.
It was the way that it was. And I didn't know anything else. No, I don't know anybody who had it differently. It was just the way it was. And that sort of discipline for working and you know, looking after your responsibilities and make sure that you live up to them, I think that's something I really have benefited from having yeah. seen from my parents.
Because you were very ill for a while, weren't you?
Yes. It was, I mean, for me, it wasn't really a big worry. I was just waiting for this to pass and then I could, you know, continue playing football. I was 15 years old. I had a really bad infection in my hip, which is something that we didn't find out until like six weeks into since I first felt it. And in that period, my mother was scared because her job was in a cancer ward in the state hospital, but it was the children's cancer ward. So she was seeing children with cancer every day, mm-hmm. looking after them, and not knowing for such a long time what was wrong with me, and experienced incredible amount of pain. She was very, very worried about that. I wasn't too worried. I was young, inexperienced, naive, whatever you want to call it. I just wanted this to pass. And of course, on the day after an operation, they found out what was really wrong with me. For me, it was just a case of, you know, then give me the right medication. Let me get through this. So that was in the summer of 78 when I was coming up to 15 years of age.
Yeah.
So I didn't play from June all the way till February the next year. And then, in all fairness, it's just come back to me because I've done the book. It's something I've really never thought about since. But looking back, it was a major thing because it could have gone either way.
I'm looking at, as I was reading the book, there's all these different bits and pieces. They're almost like driving forces. And you think, well, if that didn't happen, maybe Peter wouldn't be this way. Maybe this wouldn't happen. I know a lot of footballers are very superstitious, and all the ones I've met over the years that do all these different things. Are you like that? Because I know your mum and dad, how they met. I mean, we won't go into the whole thing now, but when you read the book, it's very bizarre how they actually managed to meet in different countries. So do you look back on things and think, well, you know what, it was kind of fate, all this stuff?
I don't think it's fate. I think it was opportunity, being in the right place at the right time, and then hard work.
Sure.
But it's interesting, the question about, you know, being superstitious. It's interesting because I agree. I've met a lot of guys, they do the same things, they have these rituals and they stick by them, and they panic if they forget something. And I was there myself. I also say that I was very, very nervous when playing for Vidoa. We played our games at 7 o'clock on Sundays. So from leaving work on Friday and all the way to the game, I was so nervous. The game was in my mind all the time.
Yeah.
I had, you know, sweaty palms and just nervous. Until I got to the warm-up of the game, and then I was okay, and in the game, also okay. I cleared that away. And also, I had rituals. I had superstitions I had to do. I took them with me when I went to Brøndby. I put you know, my shoes on in the same order. I put my back in a specific place in my car. I went a specific way. Silly things.
Oh, no.
And then I got to a point where it was so desperate for me. You know, have I remembered everything?
Mm.
And that I'm at this point, I'm in Brøndby. I'm full time professional, and we play this game against what is now FC Copenhagen. We've got five games to spare, but if we win this game, we're winning the championship. So I'm thinking, we are the best team. We've got five more chances. I'm going to do everything the opposite way now.
Wow.
So I did everything the opposite way, and won the game 1-0. And I then told myself, it's just rubbish that. And I never did it again.
Good for you.
The only thing I ever did, and I did it consistently, was when I went down to the goal that I was defending, after the touch, I would close the goal by kicking the post. That was the only thing.
Yeah.
And I could live with that.
And next, we move from the 1970s to the 1980s. And Peter makes his name in Denmark as the finest goalkeeper in the country by signing for Brøndby and then his dream move to Manchester United. When we return on My Sporting Life.
My Sporting Life with Peter Schmeichel on Talk Sport.
It's 1987, and Peter's making his name as one of the finest goalkeepers in Denmark and Scandinavia, and signs for Brøndby. Although I want to get the pronunciation right, Peter, it's Brøndby, right?
Brøndby.
Okay. You know, there's, and I've known Christian Eriksen over the years, and there's only one phrase that I know in Danish, which is very poor. You sure? It's Undskyld, hvis det ikke er dividend veninde. Which is?
It's not that bad, but the meaning behind it is bad.
Is it? Sorry, I didn't know that was your girlfriend.
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
And by the way, I've never had the chance.
It's very good.
Thank you. I've never had the chance to use it yet. Let's talk about signing for Manchester United. It's the dream. I mean, it just seems. Did it honestly all those years? And as you're moving through the ranks there, you're playing in Denmark, then you get to the national side. When did it truly? Or was it always a case where you thought, I'm going to play for them? It's always going to happen because it's an incredible story.
Yeah, that was my thinking. It's always going to happen. It was what would that thought would carry me through difficult times. And when I say difficult times, it was, you know, training, the hard training that we did, especially when Morten Olsen became our coach.
Yeah.
We for the 18 months that I had him as a coach, is the hardest 18 months I've ever experienced in football. And in truthfulness, I don't think anyone worked as hard as we did. I haven't heard anyone. Every time you told people what we were doing in training, or colleagues, other players, they're like looking at you like, whoa. I mean, the
like
guy...
Like what? What was different?
It was just really, really hard. So I'll give you an example. So first of all, our season was in the first year he was coach. Our season went in the calendar year.
Yeah.
Because, obviously, because of the weather. So you can't play in January, can't play in February. And normally the season would start through the end of March. So that period is pre-season. It's long. So it's nearly 2.5 months.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first bit of it, everything you do is physical work, running, weights. And we were kind of used to that. But when Morten came, it just became more. So, for instance, on his first day, we went, there were some woods next to the stadium. So we went and we took the long route, what we would say the long route. There's two routes and
sure. So
the long one. As we came up to where we normally would cross into the stadium, he said, no, we're going left. And then we ran even longer and came back. And that was just a taste of how this is going to pan out for the next, you know, 2.5 months. We would do weights, for instance. We'd do circuit training in weights, and we would do a circuit that would take you about 20 minutes. And then we split up in two groups. The other group would run in the forest or in the woods next. So you would come back after running and get changed and then do the circuit. And the guys just done the circuit would run. But you'd do that switch three times.
Wow.
It'd take you a little bit more than 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And you were completely drained. You would go, you'd have lunch. You would then have a rest, and then you train again in the afternoon. And you might do some ball work, but with hidden physicality in there as well. It was just very, very hard. And in those 18 months, I gained 8 kilos of muscle.
Right.
In 18 months, that's unheard of. That you don't make, you know, you don't make such a gain in such a short period of time. But what it was for me, it was brilliant because it put me in a position physically that lasted for the rest of my career.
But as a keeper, did you have, was it always the plan that you had to do? Because I know for a fact that you hated anybody that'd be cutting corners, wouldn't be doing it properly, it'd drive you crazy. Yep. But was it always the case where, look, Peter, you're going to come along with us as well? Or is it your choice?
No, I insisted. Yeah. Absolutely insisted. And that's something I had from early doors, working with especially Jørgen Henriksen, who was my coach and mentor as well,
yeah.
Goalkeeping coach and mentor. And I still, to this day, I find that incredibly important, because even now the goalkeeper is more of part of the team in build-up. You need to be with the group. They need to understand how what your skill set is And so yes, I was. I was part of everything, every run, everything. And, you know, when it became really, really hard, very, very hard, that thought, if you quit now, if you cut that corner, you will never play for Manchester United.
Wow.
That was in my head. That was my thing. Sometimes you have that incredible urge just to pack it in and say, no, I'm not doing this anymore.
So it's always Manchester United was in there?
And then it was that thought that made me carry on.
So how did it happen? Are you telling people, like, I want it known that I want to play there? Or did they just come to you?
Different time, remember. No social media, no big sort of media exposure.
No telephones.
That opportunity wasn't there. But I got approached by an agent, which was, again, for the time, was unusual, who said he wanted to work with me. We'd had agents that would come to you and say, I've got this club, but it was more like an opportunity to see if they couldn't, you know, put you somewhere. And if you said yes, oh, I'd love that, they'd go and say to the club, we've got this player. So it wasn't really,
sure.
It wasn't real. But this guy came up to me and said, I followed you. I think you're really good. I think there's a future for you away from Bromby, and I really like to work with you. What do you want? I mean, what is your wishes? And I say, I want to get to Manchester United. Mm. And he said, fine, I can work with that. And he then started to strike up a relationship with Alex Ferguson. And very, very sort of, quite quickly, he became aware of me. And coincidentally, one of the second pre-season I had with Morton, we actually ended up being in the same hotel as Manchester United, using the same training facilities. We were there for pre-season training. They were there as sort of like a 3-day break before.
Hold on. So you're there now. I mean, you're what, 26, 27 years old, I guess?
Yeah.
You're a professional. You're playing for Denmark. But is there that little boy inside of you that's going, oh, my God, this could be it now?
Not really.
No.
I'm going, oh, my God, that's Steve Bruce. That is Mark Hughes. Oh, Brian Robb. I mean, that's how I went.
Yeah.
It was a really difficult period for Manchester United.
Yeah.
So we're late January, and they hadn't won a game since November. Fergie was under pressure. The media wanted him gone. The fans wanted him gone. And they had this FA Cup game against Hereford. And, of course, a game they needed to win.
Hereford's 11 cost a paltry £68,000 in comparison, but it's their biggest ever day, and the possibility of a giant-killing act must be haunting the United manager, Alex Ferguson.
And so he took them away for 3 days. They took priority because they were Manchester United on the training pitch. And this is something that Fergus told me, that after one of their trainings, and we started to train then after them, he stayed back, but not by the pitch. He was hiding in the trees or the bushes or whatever, and he was looking at this kid, which I wasn't even a kid, but this blonde guy,
yeah,
shouting and screaming and diving everywhere, saving everything. That's how he said it. You know? And I'm thinking, I know about this guy. I've been told about this guy, and that's where his interest started. And from that point on, he was then sending Alan Hutchinson's, who was the goalkeeping coach, he was sending him out to scout me.
Did you know all this all along at the time?
No. This is
what would you've been
no,
like?
No,
it had
no,
you.
No, this is Sir Alex, years later,
standing behind you, watching you, and you're going, "This is the thing I've always dreamed of."
No. I didn't know anything about this. In fact, there was very little sort of contact between the two camps, but we just sort of crossed path in the hotel maybe, and they were only there for 3 days, and we were there for 2 weeks. So
it was tricky, though, wasn't it, to try and get there, because then you ended up having to stay at Bromby before you went to Manchester United.
Yeah,
this must have been really difficult for you.
It was another challenge as well. But yeah.
Yeah.
So there was a foreigner rule in place.
Yeah.
So you could only have so many foreigners.
Of course.
So it wasn't like you can just bring anybody in. And especially in Europe, you know, Italy could only have two foreigners. But the first approach was 1990. The clubs they spoke, and Bromby asked for too much money, so the deal didn't happen, and I'd played it was actually a really good day for me. I was in a hotel in Kensington, preparing for a game against England. And I got this phone call off the agent, and he said, "Well, it's official now. There are three clubs that has made an approach, an official bid for you, and it was West Ham, and it was Liverpool, and it was Manchester United."
Oh, it's a tricky decision for you.
Oh my God, I spent hours musing over what to do.
Or is that seconds?
So in a split second, that was decided, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, we go with Manchester United. So that approach was made. And I played the game. One of my big, big dreams was to play at Wembley.
Yeah.
And that happened that day.
One second, little flick from Gascoigne. Gascoigne goes on. And got round Sivarek. A bit of basketball from Schmeichel at the end, but Gascoigne got the better of Vilfort then. Schmeichel certainly did well to deny Gascoigne.
Unfortunately, we lost the game 1-0, but I personally had a really good game, and you know, I was talk of the newspapers the next day, which made me even more, you know, proud, because at first I knew this about Man United. I knew, and seeing the newspapers that, you know, they were taking notice of me, and came back home to Denmark. The chairman of Brøndby, Per Bjerregaard, phoned me up, confirmed what I already knew, asked me what to do, and I said Manchester United, and that was the last thing I heard.
Mm.
Didn't hear anything for months. I knew what was happening because the agent obviously was keeping me in the loop. So I knew it was asking for too much money, and it didn't happen.
So when it did?
Well, I had an experience which I think it sums Alex Ferguson up in many ways, and how he manages and how good a manager he then is. So I had a phone call a couple of months later. I was devastated. I was devastated, and it made me even more determined to become even better, work harder, and make sure that I was getting away from Brøndby, because, you know, and I wanted to be the best I could ever be, and I've lost this opportunity. So a couple of months later, I get a phone call of someone who helped my agent out. And he said, "Come to my house after training." And I did. And Alex Ferguson, he was in the house. I don't even know if I said hi. I was gobsmacked.
Mm.
And he said, he was very disappointed that the deal didn't happen. But he knew that it was me he wanted. So he just wanted to make sure that I understood that he would come back for me in the summer. And he wanted me to make sure that I worked hard and progressed. So when I finally joined Manchester United, I would be at that level that he'd seen me at. And then he stood up and left. And I still, even to this day, I'm not sure I said anything. I was just completely, I was stumped. That's not happened many times in my life.
Well, they say all good things come to those who wait. And Peter certainly had to wait. And it was good. It was very good. The glory years at Manchester United under Sir Alex Ferguson, when we return on My Sporting Life.
My Sporting Life with Peter Schmeichel on Talk Sport.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
We'll be right back. My Sporting Life. Paul Coit in conversation with Peter Schmeichel on Talk Sport.
It's 1991, and Peter, you make your dream move in the summer of that year to Manchester United and then go on to play 398 games for the club, winning pretty much absolutely everything there is to win. But tell me this, is there a thrill like the moment you play for them for the very first time, for your debut, when you've always supported the club as a boy?
Oh, my God. Actually, my first game at Old Trafford was even better, because that was Sir Matt Busby's testimonial.
Sir Matt Busby taking to Old Trafford again to personally thank the players of Manchester United and the Republic of Ireland for supporting this very special occasion. There's the other new face, Peter Schmeichel.
It wasn't a full house, which was a little of a disappointment, but near enough. So I'm playing at Old Trafford. Sir Matt's in the, he's the main guy for this game. We're playing Ireland. I can't remember the, I honestly can't remember what the score was. But I'm now here, I know I've signed a contract, but I'm now here. I've got the number one shirt. I'm playing for Manchester United. I can look down and I can see the badge. And that was a moment of immense proudness for me.
I can imagine. Yeah. Did it ever go? Was it always there? Did it always stay with you?
Always.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And tell me about your relationship. This is the question I know you'd be asked a million times. And probably the phrase people have stopped you and go, what's Sir Alex Ferguson like? I'd rather word it slightly differently, but tell me about your experiences with him, because there was great stuff, there was average stuff, and there was probably stuff that wasn't so great for you. But what was your relationship like?
No, I have a brilliant relationship with him, even to this day. I've actually spoken to him today. So, I think when you... we're in a career where it's there's so much spotlight on you, you need very, very strong leaders. You need somebody who takes care of you, someone that you feel safe around.
Yeah,
that he's not gonna double cross you. He's not gonna hurt you. He's gonna protect you all the time, and he's gonna be up front. He's gonna be honest with you, we had that with Sir Alex. You were never in doubt of anything with him, which makes it easier to be a Man United player or a high-profile football player. You could always approach him. You could always talk to him about everything, anything, everything. You could always knock on his door, no matter what it was, and he would take the time. He knew about your family. He knew your background. He knew the names of your friends that kept coming, and visiting, he would take time to speak to them. So if I brought friends, for instance, to the cliff for a training session, he would recognize them, and at some point during that training session, he would walk over and have a chat, and he would do that consistently with everybody.
People always imagine the hairdryer thing. That's always when everybody talks about it. Is that part of him, or is that not really him at all?
It's the one thing I don't like being part of, the media and in the public eye, is this headline reporting.
Yeah.
It's a headline. That's sure. What it is. It's nothing but that. Does the hairdryer exist? Yes, of course it does. Is it a necessary thing? It's a brilliant thing. It's an absolute brilliant thing, because sometimes you need that kind of explosion to change path. I've been at the end of the hairdryer a couple of times. I think most players have. But with that is, and this is where I think he's really brilliant, is when I said before, you know where you stand. He can be very angry after a game for whatever reason. Yeah. Even a game you won 3-0, there would be something there that he might not have been happy with, and he would tell you in whatever way he told you. But what you knew for absolutely sure, that once it was told, sure. And he never went back to it. And this is the trust part, This is the trust part. I said so. Once he said, "Get your bath," that was it. Then you moved on to the next one, and it's important to have it like that, because any kind of insecurity that can sneak in on you. That can be the difference of, you missing a chance as a striker, or me, you're making a mistake for a goal. I needed to be absolutely sure that I had the backing of the manager. I had the backing that I was okay and there was nothing wrong with me. So that clarity was I've never seen that anywhere as good as that. That clarity was absolutely instrumental in everything that we did and everything that we achieved.
When did you notice that the team, now we are truly going places? Because you said that when you start, you know, things aren't looking so great at Manchester United, and then you're becoming the greatest team the Premier League has ever seen. So where was the change and when did you notice it?
I think when I first, the first couple of games I played, I'm thinking, wow, this is a fantastic team. What we didn't have was we had a lot of experience and then we had a lot of non-experience. So we had, you know, players like Ryan Giggs who made the team incredibly interesting. You know, things that he could do. Even in the games, you could sometimes just got taken out of your sort of your zone, the concentration mode that you're in, and just enjoy what he was doing. But he was young. And the thing about young players is that they can deliver that kind of brilliance, but they can't deliver it every time. You know, they will be up and down. And also an experience in, you know, players like Andriy Kanchelskis, who came from Russia, you know, into a completely different world. He needed a little bit of time to get into it as well. And there are certain other young players who you needed time. And I'm thinking in my first year, what a team we have, and we should be winning the championship, because I'm thinking we are the best team. But at some point during that season, we ran out of steam and struggling scoring goals. And I thought we should have won the championship. Yeah. We didn't. But by not winning it, it put us in a much, much better situation or position for the next coming years because of the experience that we gained. And of course, the major adjustment was Eric coming in the next season. So he came halfway through there. And what he brought was exactly what we needed. We needed something that was different, something that was not... So the way we played back then, in everyone played kind of the same system, kind of in the same way. And the difference was the quality of the players. So you could kind of predict what was going to happen next. And then it came down to the quality of the cross, or the quality of the guy meeting the ball, the position, the cleverness, all that. But with Eric, we got a completely new dimension. We got play through the middle, play on the ground through the middle. And of course, that got enhanced, that quality got enhanced when players like Scholes came into the team, that we could play that kind of play from further down the pitch. So the evolution of the team was incredible. But that second season, as soon as Eric walked through the door in the dressing room, I knew that, you know, we were on the path of becoming a great team.
Because he'd been around, and some people would be thinking, well, you know, Eric Cantona may be not the right fit. You know, he moves from club to club, whereas I believe Fergie saw that as an advantage, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely. I think when he was scouting players, he would look for the odd thing in the personality. He was looking for that. Normality, so people that are deemed normal, they need to be very, very skillful, very, very good,
sure,
in order to sort of be that guy on the pitch that you want. But the guys who are very good but also has a little sort of difference in their personality, they are more valuable because they're more likely to do something which is unexpected in a game. And when you don't expect it as an opponent, it is a surprise.
And as fans, that's what we love.
Of course.
That's what we love to see.
Cantona again. It's almost as if he's got a baton in his hand and is conducting the orchestra. Giggs, oh, it's a super ball, and Cantona is there where it matters.
So Premier League, 93, 94, 96, 97, 99, the FA Cup in 94, 96 and 99, things are moving very well. Are you just like, are you enjoying every minute of it now? Are you just like thinking, this is everything I want to do, I'm winning everything, I'm with my club, and this is just as good as it could possibly get?
Yeah, I mean, it is my club. It's in my heart. I really love the football club. I love the people that are in the football club. I love being around, because I went around every day. You know, the Cliff, I obviously met people there. I went to Old Trafford every single day. I did my mail. I went to the offices. It was a smaller, it was a smaller business back then, if you like.
Yeah.
It was fewer people. Had a chat, had a coffee. I just absolutely love being around the football club. But of course, my mentality is and has always been to move upwards, always trying to achieve something new and something better, always setting a target for the season. This is what we have to achieve. And of course, Europe was, that was the one area that we were struggling in.
Well, it took until the 26th of May, 1999, and Peter's final game for the club at the Nou Camp versus Bayern Munich in the Champions League final, and one of the greatest nights in the history of Manchester United Football Club. Coming up next. You're
unbelievable. My Sporting Life. Paul Coits in conversation with Peter Schmeichel on Talk Sports.
By the start of the 1998-99 season, Manchester United had become one of the greatest domestic sides of all time. In Peter Schmeichel's time there, they'd won the Premier League four times, FA Cup three times, and a League Cup. But although Peter had won the Euros with Denmark, Champions League success had still evaded them. And that season, Peter, unbeknownst to anybody, you decided this was going to be your last as a Manchester United player.
Why? I did. I mean, we don't have that much time, and I think just in order so we get the story completely straight, it's much better to read it, because I really go into detail. Sure. I go into detail about how I felt. I came back from the World Cup in France in 1998. We've been with Denmark. We've been relatively successful getting into the quarterfinals. The quarterfinals were played on July the 3rd that year, and we'd only finished runners-up to Arsenal the year before, which meant back then that the runners-up, in order to get into the Champions League group play, we had to play a playoff match.
Yeah.
And that was already on August the 4th. So having played the last game in the World Cup, the next very important game, probably the most important game of the season, was 4 weeks away. Everyone needs a long break after a long season, and especially if you've played a World Cup, because then the season has lasted for 11 months.
Mm.
And I'm a player trying to play every game. So I was spent at that time. I really was spent. I needed that break, but I couldn't. I had a week. Because that game, we played the Polish team. That game was just the most important game. And you know, when you get knocked out of a World Cup, you phone the manager, and he was very apologetic, said, "Pete, I would really wanted to give you a longer break, but those are our most important games."
Sure.
So I came back quite soon after being knocked out of the World Cup, and I remember sitting in my car on my way to the Cliff training ground thinking, I can't face this, you know. This is going to be another year of, you know, just game after game after game after game, no breaks. The next break I will get is, 10 and a half months away, depending on how successful we are. So I decided in the car that it was probably a good idea to make this my last season. And I had a couple of days to think about how to approach it.
Who knew?
Me.
Just you.
Just me. This is why I think it's beneficial to read how I go about this. I spend a lot of time on my thinking process. And also, for instance, the way that the Euros were this season and how COVID has affected the calendar. I know there's a lot of players there who will feel the same as I felt. Mm. And it could be very beneficial for them to have the words of somebody else who ended up making a decision in a period of his life where he was not in clear-minded enough and not in a position to make a rational decision based on what was real and what was not real. Mm. It was based on feelings mm. of especially mentally tiredness. So I made a decision, and the way I am, you know, you make a decision and you stick by it. And that was it. At the time, I thought it was a fitting, really fitting ending for me to finish winning the treble and, you know, the European Cup and all that.
What a way to go.
But when you get to my age and you're doing a project like I've done with the book, and you look back and you realize that, you know, it was probably the wrong decision.
Right.
I should have opened up a bit more. I didn't know at the time. I didn't know. It's a lot different today. There's a lot more talk about players' mental state and looking after players in different ways, giving them rest, taking them out of travel, stuff like that. And it's much more acknowledged and used as a tool today. But it wasn't back then. My thinking was, I'm this big, strong guy. You cannot break me. And you know, if I open up about how I'm feeling and that given that particular moment, I wasn't feeling great.
Hmm.
I was so tired. My mind was so tired, and I really needed to get away from football. But had I opened up about that, I feared that I would have been deemed, you know, too old now, and you know, you're feeling this because you're not good enough, and all these kind of things. But in today's football, in today's sport, and other sports at the time, by the way, that was quite normal.
Mm.
And I should have involved people and spoken about this to people. I didn't.
Well, you know what? You look back and think, well, what could have I could have added another couple of Premier Leagues, maybe a couple. I mean, the trophy cabinet's pretty full. You can't really have too many regrets over your career, can you? But if we look at 99, and let's just talk about that, because if anybody is going to cap a career at a football club, I mean, my goodness, what a way to go. And there's this talk about, and you put this in the book, this risk mode. And I love this risk mode of playing football. And this is, you're 1-0 down against Bayern Munich in the Nou Camp. Everybody's seen it, 26th of May, 1999. Just give me some idea of what it was like for Peter Schmeichel in those last few minutes.
I tell you what, if they can equalise, and I'm not betting against them, I think they'll win this. They're going to win it. Solskjaer!
Well, they're now creating chances for fun.
That was no different to any other game.
Is that right? Is that the secret, though? You always stay the same?
Yeah.
Never gets to
you? I think really that is a secret. You can't put in... When you're in the build-up, yes, you can't avoid it. But once you're in there, you cannot put more importance to a game than another game. It has to be the same. You have to do the same. Everything, the difference between the teams at that level, it's so minute, it's so small, that if you spend just, you know, half a percentage of your focus or concentration on thinking about the importance of the game, that could end up being the difference.
Mm.
So you have to build some kind of system that keeps you in that same mode all the time. So I didn't think about, you know, we're 1-0 down or we're losing this final. I'm thinking that we're 1-0 down and we can get back. Of course we can get back, but this is what we do. We're very, very good, and we get to this point of a game, instinctively we know we now have to take more chances. We have to go into what I call risk mode. I couldn't find another word. I just find that word is it perfect in how I think about those situations. So you gamble more. You have more players staying forward. You defend with less players. You build up changes. You get more basic. You have diagonal passes, you know, that are more than 50 yards,
yeah,
for players to head them on and stuff like that. Things that you probably wouldn't do in the first part of a game, and you just push on and push on. And without thinking about it, you accept that you're going to concede chances. And in conceding chances, from a goalkeeper's point of view, it's more like, come on, and then just hit the shot or whatever so I can get the ball so we can, you know, chase that goal.
Yeah.
You don't think about, please don't shoot because you might score. That's gone. All that's gone. You're behind. If you're behind, you're behind. What can you do about that? The only thing you can do is to get level. So that's a whole point of that. You just do that. And it's interesting in the final, because when you have to illustrate how it works, it's Gary Neville who wins a corner we score from. But Gary Neville's a right fullback, but he wins a corner on the left-hand side. He's been over there to take a long throw-in, but stayed, and he's in full risk mode. He knows that he's missing from the defense, but he trusts the guys, which is Jaap Stam at the time and Ronnie. He trusts them. If anything happens, at least, if not save the situation, at least delay so he can come back and maybe support from. And this is just instinctively how we played, and we did that so many times in that season. And you know, I can't tell you any more.
What was the? How did you feel when the winner went?
Beckham into Sheringham and Solskjaer has won it.
Is it a relief or is it an incredible jubilation you feel? Or are you still thinking I got a job to do here?
Oh, I was panicking.
Were you?
You think you don't stop risk more, so yeah. you continue, and that's how we scored the second goal. But once we're 2-1 up, we are now the team has got something to lose. And there are two things there that played on my mind. Once when we equalised, I knew we were going to go into golden goal. And golden goal was if anyone who scores in the first half, I think it is,
game over.
Then the game is over. I'd never played that game. And the goalkeeper obviously can play a big part in that negatively. So I'm like... getting my pulse back down, taking deep breath, preparing myself for this, that's going to happen. Then we score. And, you know, I have my first instinct is to just run up there, but I say, oh, no, because there might be time left, you know. So once we restart, I'm thinking, wow, we're 2-1 up. Now we've got something to lose. And they have the ball, and I'm like, I kind of felt like I froze. I'm thinking, don't shoot. Please, you know, 5 minutes ago, I'm thinking, shoot, so I can get the ball. Now I'm thinking, don't shoot. I am not in any position. I'm not capable of saving anything. And it was literally just seconds, but it felt, you know, felt quite long. And then the whistle went, and then I went completely blank.
Oh, did you really? So when we talk about my sporting life to round this up, and you know, we haven't even talked about Denmark and the Euros and that incredible situation as well, was that it? If there was one that you could choose from everything, the ultimate moment in your sporting career, would it be that? Would that be the end of it?
It's for me, I get this question quite often. It's one of three. I can't choose between them. It's, of course, that. It's Denmark 92, but also winning the first Premier League. The first Premier League was special, really special. 27 years of hurt from Man United fans, and you physically felt that relief. And to have won the first Premier League as well, even though the significance of that at the time didn't really play into my mind or my thinking. But now I understand how important that was.
Sure. Peter, an hour is no time to fit your whole life into, and I feel as if we've only just scratched the surface. I think we'll have to do a part two, but I've learnt a lot of things I didn't know about you, and thank you so much for taking part in My Sporting Life. Peter Schmeich.
Thank you.
My Sporting Life on Talk Sport.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.